You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Ghost in the Machine by Mark Rosso. One ghostwriter on big movies mentioned getting $1,500 per minute of music. When it comes to royalties, the veteran Hollywood music person told me, the standard split with the lead composer is 50-50 per cue, even if the additional or ghost composer does all the work. After all, the lead composer is putting a roof over everybody's head. In certain studios, if the lead composer does anything on the cue, suggests that the tambourine be lowered in the mix, for instance, the lead composer's share can increase to 75%. And if the cue comes back from the studio, network, or streamer with a note, a requested change, then the lead composer can take 100%. It is thought that this motivates the minions to deliver flawless cues. 2 years ago, Nadia Wheaton, a composer and music production coordinator, posted a soul-bearing account on her website of her frustrations as an aspiring Hollywood film scorer. Despite some notable successes, she found herself making painful budget decisions, such as whether to spend money on gas or on food. She wrote about the specter of homelessness and about studio assistants being paid $12 an hour with no overtime. It felt like some of our idols were just there to exploit new talent, she wrote. Wharton ultimately left Hollywood and turned her focus toward video game music. A lot of people have come out of that system feeling that they were abused and not wanting to do it anymore, the composer Carter Burwell told me when I went to see him at his home studio on Long Island's East End. But then some people come out, hang up their own shingle, and become a successful film composer. So it's a sink or swim situation. Burwell, who is 67, has a sage-like aura. He graduated from Harvard and was playing in downtown Manhattan post-punk bands when Joel and Ethan Coen asked him to score their 1984 film Blood Simple. He has since been nominated for Oscars, Golden Globes, and BAFTAs, and has won a Primetime Emmy for his work, which has ranged from the infernal yodels of Raising Arizona to the somber tones of Fargo. The day I visited, he was working in his studio, a low-key, go-it-alone operation far removed from, say, Zimmer's remote control, which boasts an army of studio assistants and collaborators. Burwell built this studio inside a modernist house, drenched with sunlight, and set amid a dramatic dunescape with forever views of the Atlantic. I would not have been able to buy this house if it weren't for the performance royalties for Twilight, he told me. It's as simple as that. He said that your music, your future, was established to remind young composers that they need not give up their royalties. ASCAP President Paul Williams, the Grammy and Oscar-winning songwriter who gave us the Muppet movie's eternally wistful anthem, The Rainbow Connection, emphasized the you-never-know-ness of working as a composer. The Love Boat, we thought it wasn't going to last 4 weeks, he told me, and it went on for 11 years. It is those hits that really helped pay the bills. And I am very happy I never gave up my ongoing royalties. The royalty system goes back to 1914, when the composer Victor Herbert, having sued a restaurant for using his music without permission, won a Supreme Court decision entitling him to ongoing payments. Herbert then went on to co-found the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, ASCAP. It was very highly structured, and it made a predictable business model, Burwell said. For most composers, the rule of thumb is that the upfront fee paid by a studio or streamer, goes into the production. It covers your time, any studio fees, and the musicians you hire. The back-end royalties, which you receive in exchange for forking over your copyright, represent your income, the steady drip that can continue for years. According to music law experts Todd and Jeff Brabeck, a composer can earn more than $200,000 over the course of 5 years from a typical film, and considerably more from a box office hit. Half the income that the composer used to get comes from royalties, the Hollywood composer told me, and now streaming is throwing that way off balance. The open letter to the pros said that streaming releases ultimately pay just 5 to 10% as much as comparably budgeted theatrical projects. Netflix presents itself as a tech company, not an entertainment company, Burwell said, echoing a broadly held sentiment. They don't feel obliged to follow the norms of the entertainment industry at all. According to Nielsen, which last year began reporting improved streaming ratings numbers, American viewers opt for streaming offerings on television about a third of the time, a percentage that is growing exponentially. Last fall, when the New York Times asked Zimmer if he was worried about streaming cutting into his studio's revenue, he responded tartly, "I stopped being worried about it because it's already happened." Last October, Netflix sent three of its music executives to the Society of Composers and Lyricists annual meeting held online. "We're trying to find the best way to pay composers," Amy Dunning, Netflix's vice president of music, creative, and production, told the group. The executives suggested that the problem of distributing royalties lay with the pros, and said that composers who don't want to take buyouts can simply reject that clause when negotiating their contracts. Something many early career composers are understandably hesitant to do. The buyout model was described as a work in progress that would evolve as Netflix continues to navigate the innovation curve. Such talk sounds odd, coming from a company whose 2020 revenue reportedly clocked in at $24.9 billion. It's well past the shaky startup phase. According to a veteran Los Angeles music lawyer who specializes in digital, the streamers pay 1% of their total revenue to ASCAP, BMI, and other pros. Netflix declined to make their executives available for comment in this story. Composers understandably see their work as having contributed to the streamers' remarkable success and believe they should benefit from it. When I talked to Chris Bowers, the 32-year-old Juilliard-trained jazz pianist and producer who scored the Netflix mega-hit Bridgerton, he said, "We're not having a conversation about actors not getting back-end. Our music is a representation of ourselves, even if it's not actually us on that screen." With back-end royalties dwindling or cut out of the equation entirely, there's a growing feeling of disgruntlement in the vast community of additional and ghost composers who fuel the Hollywood music studios. Zimmer's remote control studio is perhaps the most cited avatar of the hyper-collaborative system that has taken root in blockbuster-focused Hollywood as deadlines tighten, pressures mount, and digital editing forces scorers to aim at moving targets. Scenes can be tweaked ad infinitum before reaching picture lock. A website devoted to Zimmer credits the many collaborators who make up the remote control team. There are 66 composers, 74 co-composers, 28 arrangers, 72 additional arrangers, and 23 credited with additional music. 16 more people in various capacities round out the list, bringing the total to 279. "If Zimmer can't get a cue right," one composer told me, "he has 60 people behind him, willing to give it a shot." Zimmer is arguably Hollywood's top film scorer, a visionary innovator who once played keyboards in the Buggles and who happens to be extremely intelligent and ultra-charming. He is a regular presence on VI Control, where he is also the number one topic. Is he overrated? Is he a genius? Does he actually compose? It's almost like he's a sound designer with notes, one poster said. Zimmer, who is 64, is probably best known for that epic brum, an unforgettable sonic rumble that became so imitated that Zimmer himself professed to be tired of it. In 2013, after Zimmer did an interview with Vulture about Inception, a ghost composer named Mike Zarin came forward to claim that he was, in fact, the author of Brahm, venting his frustration to IndieWire. Seeing someone on the inside who knows exactly how everything happened, outright lying, that bothered me. Zimmer declined to speak for this story. Zimmer is sometimes asked to address the issue of authorship. I make them partners in the project, he said, of his team last fall when Dune was released. I try to give them credit. For him, cinema is a communal experience, and so is creating the music for it. I try to be fair, he has said, but sometimes it's just not possible. There are complications involving the runtime of end credits, the maddening bureaucracy of cue sheets. One composer I spoke with said that the perception in the industry is that Zimmer is doing better with giving credit than he had been in the past. ASCAP award-winning composer Deborah Lurie, who wrote the luminous score of the 2010 film Dear John, has worked as an arranger with Katy Perry, confirmed that credit can be complicated. But for her, collaboration is not the issue. I think that the issue is honesty, is secrets. Gifted with perfect pitch and impeccable chops, Lurie began her career more than two decades ago, working with the ubiquitous Danny Elfman, Batman, Men in Black, 50 Shades of Grey, whom she describes as one of the good guys in the business, hands-on with his music. That is, he works closely with his additional composers. In the conversations I had, certain composers tended to come up in this good guy category, such as Mothersbaugh, who is generous and assiduous about sharing credit, and Powell, who is known for boosting assistants up the ladder. She soon became one of the most successful women composers in Hollywood, a field that is, perhaps needless to say, dominated by men. In 2020, the Grammy-nominated pianist and composer Nomi Abadi founded the Female Composer Safety League, an organization dedicated to the empowerment of women working in the industry. As one music executive told The Hollywood Reporter last year, sexual harassment in composing is pretty widespread. When I spoke with Lurie, she referred to what she called a paradigm, meaning the golden image of what a Hollywood composer is. Lurie had always aspired to this ideal, Mancini, Williams, and their ilk, but found her old-school, go-it-alone ethos increasingly difficult to sustain in streaming-era Hollywood. Here I was, a bleeding-heart, totally emotional artist, who just thought about the movie 24/7, she said. She didn't want to be a brand or a figurehead, or be told, as she was, to just phone it in. A couple of years ago, Lurie decided to take a breather from the business. She argues that transparency is what's needed, a Hollywood music culture that can emerge from the shadows and be frank about what it is. I'm not even trying to turn back the clock, Lurie insisted. I'm trying to figure out how to make things proudly be what they are. In such a world, star composers would be open about the fact that they are delegators. Ghost composers would get credit, assistants wouldn't feel hopeless, and everyone would be fairly compensated. More than three decades ago, Mancini noted, with the new technology that keeps entering the media, film composers are constantly being placed in new learning situations. There is, admittedly, a bit of plus-a-change to it all. Yet Lurie articulated what many in the composing community say among themselves. There was a business that I loved, and I thought it was my life, and now, as things changed, not so much. Even so, there's hope that things will improve. Happy endings, after all, are what Hollywood is about. Some of the change will come from the inside. As Joe Kramer vowed on Twitter last year, throwing a challenge to his fellow composers, I promise not to hire an assistant who is really a ghostwriter. Zimmer has admitted, I think we need to be fairer. Speaking to the financial side, so disrupted by streaming, the Hollywood composer told me, in 10 years the market will figure out how this works. Focusing on the artistic side, Lurie, who keeps getting calls to compose music for Hollywood and has been considered getting back into the game, struck a similar chord of optimism. I want to believe that there's still a demand for artists that live and breathe one project at a time, the kind of projects that require human musicians and things that essentially only humans can do, she said. If there's still a love for that, if people want to leave a movie humming the theme, there has to be a business model that reemerges. And I have a vision that there will be a new interest in that ultra-human, painstaking kind of music work again. Otherwise, as the Hollywood composer said, waiting in his home studio for the next gig, how are composers going to survive?
Thank you.
Son of a Preacher Man by Gabriel Sherman, with photographs by Gillian Laub. Jerry Falwell Jr. was the Trump-anointing dark prince of the Christian right. But after a sex scandal rocked his marriage and ended his lucrative stewardship of Liberty University, he's ready to admit he never had much use for his father's church anyway. Opening photo, prodigal son, Jerry Falwell Jr. and Becky Falwell with their dogs, Chance and Sandy, in a 1941 Ford coupe they bought last year from rocker Jerry Lee Lewis. On the morning of August 18, 2021, Liberty University's freshman class began arriving on campus in Lynchburg, Virginia, for the start of Welcome Week. The kickoff to the fall semester had the exuberance of a pregame pep rally. An outdoor sound system blasted Gary Glitter's glam rock anthem, Rock and Roll Part 2. Student greeters in Navy Liberty T-shirts whooped and cheered when a new arrival's car pulled up to the dorms. Buildings all over the Jeffersonian-style campus were festooned with banners that read, Liberty University, 50 years of training champions for Christ. For 49 of those years, a member of the Falwell family had run Liberty, the country's most influential evangelical university. But the day before orientation started, Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of the late televangelist Jerry Falwell Sr., and the school's president and chancellor from 2007 to 2020, was nowhere near campus. He was driving a white Jeep Wrangler along a dirt road on his 500-acre farm about 20 miles west of Lynchburg. "That's the tallest mountain in Virginia," he said, pointing at the Appalachian peaks rising in the distance. Ahead of us, Black Angus cattle grazed in fenced pastures. At the edge of the property stood a 19th-century chapel, no larger than a one-room schoolhouse. Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant both worshipped in that church on different days, Falwell said in his laconic drawl. It was the first time I met Falwell in person. Behind the wheel, the 59-year-old looked like a prosperous country lawyer-turned-gentleman farmer. He was dressed in a lavender polo, dark jeans, and chestnut-brown leather sneakers. He had neatly parted silver hair and a trim silver beard on his round face. His wolf-like ice-blue eyes were the only visible signs of the feral personality that had recently cost him his job and reputation. On August 24, 2020, Falwell resigned from Liberty in the wake of a sensational tabloid scandal that could have been dreamed up in the writer's room of the Righteous Gemstones. A former Miami pool boy named Giancarlo Granda claimed he had a nearly seven-year affair with Falwell's wife, Becky, and that Falwell often liked to watch them have sex. Granda went on a national media tour. He gave interviews to ABC News, CNN, Reuters, Politico, and The Washington Post, and said the Falwells began grooming him when he was 20 and bought his silence with luxury vacations, rides on Liberty's private jet, and an ownership stake managing a Miami Beach hostel. To bolster his claims, Granda released screenshots of FaceTime calls and text conversations with Becky. "I'm not wearing any panties," she allegedly wrote Granda in one message. Falwell released a statement that acknowledged Becky and Granda's relationship, but he vehemently denied watching the tryst. Instead, Falwell said he was the real victim of a fatal attraction-type extortion plot after Granda demanded $2 million to keep the affair secret. Viewed in hindsight, the scandal was the combustion of a self-immolating fire that Falwell had been stoking for months, if not years. Liberty had spent the better part of 2020 lurching from one PR crisis to the next, brought on by Falwell's boorish and reckless behavior, his race-baiting, COVID-19 denials, and slavish devotion to Donald Trump. 2 days after George Floyd's murder in May 2020, Falwell tweeted a picture of a COVID mask that showed a man in blackface posing with a man in a KKK hood. In early August 2020, Falwell posted a photo on Instagram of himself aboard a yacht with his pants unzipped, a drink in one hand, and his other arm wrapped around a pregnant Liberty employee with her belly exposed. The controversies turned Falwell into an avatar of the rank hypocrisy, know-nothingism, and toxic masculinity that explained why 81% of white evangelical Christians voted in 2016 for Trump. A thrice-married reality TV star who literally boasted of grabbing women by the crotch. The day Falwell resigned from Liberty, he gave an interview to his local NPR station and invoked the peroration of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last," Falwell said. He offered no other explanation for his spectacular meltdown. People inside and outside Liberty were left asking what had caused Falwell, a married father of three, to completely self-destruct in public. He was a University of Virginia-trained lawyer and successful real estate developer. He rescued Liberty from near bankruptcy and transformed the nonprofit university into a financial powerhouse with more than 100,000 students and a $1.7 billion endowment. Over the course of a few months, he blew it all up. Why? I had gone to the farm to find out. After giving me the tour, Falwell parked in front of a handsome farmhouse. Becky was waiting at the front door in jeans, sandals, and a black T-shirt that matched her long raven hair. She apologized about the exercise bike sitting incongruously in the foyer. "I tried riding it, but it killed my butt because the seat is slanted," she said as we entered. "I don't know what we're going to do with it," Falwell complained. Becky told him to drag it to the garage and disappeared down the hall. I found her on the patio, checking on their golden retriever, Sandy, who was patiently nursing a litter of four-week-old puppies. The father, a shaggy 8-year-old named Chance, dozed on the floor. "He's an old lazy man," Becky said. A short while later, the Falwells sat in the kitchen and began to talk about the tumultuous events of the past 2 years. The wide-ranging conversation was one of many we had over the past 8 months. What emerged was an intimate look inside a very public marriage, as well as a Shakespearean drama about fathers and sons and the burden of legacy. For the first time, Falwell opened up about his true spiritual beliefs and how they diverge from those of his infamous father, who co-founded the Moral Majority and waged a scorched earth cultural war for 4 decades. When I told Falwell that many people thought he, consciously or not, wanted to destroy himself, he considered it for a moment. "Subconsciously, yeah, I believe that's true," he said, nodding. "It's almost like I didn't have a choice." He went on, "Because of my last name, people think I'm a religious person, but I'm not. My goal was to make them realize I was not my dad." When you think of Jerry Falwell Sr., chances are you remember him as the Falstaffian televangelist who never refused an opportunity to say something outrageously offensive on camera. Falwell's back catalog of homophobic, racist, and misogynistic comments is as thick as the King James Bible. In a 1958 sermon, Falwell inveighed against the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision that on paper integrated public schools. "The facility should be separate. When God has drawn a line of distinction, we should not attempt to cross that line," Falwell said. During a 1976 service, Falwell preached, "The idea that religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to prevent Christians from running their own country." In the mid-1990s, Falwell promoted the Clinton Chronicles, $43, a right-wing propaganda video that accused the Clintons of a raft of crimes, up to and including murder. And days after 9/11, Falwell went on television and blamed the terrorist attacks on gays, lesbians, feminists, abortion doctors, and the ACLU. "I point the finger in their faces and say, 'You helped this happen,'" Falwell said. While Jerry Falwell Sr. was a polarizing scold in public, an agent of intolerance, John McCain once said, Jerry Jr. remembered his father as lenient at home. "My dad wasn't one of those overbearing parents who tried to control their kids," he recalled. "The elder Falwell didn't force his namesake to attend church and didn't care that his son collected Fleetwood Mac and Beatles records at a time when Baptists called rock and roll devil's music. He also didn't object when Jerry declared at an early age that he didn't want to spread the good word. People would say to me, 'We know you're going to be a preacher because your dad is one.' I thought, 'That's the last thing I want to be,'" Jerry said. He even tolerated Jerry's moderate drinking, despite preaching that alcohol was the worst, most offensive drug in American society. "I asked him one time, 'Why don't you drink? Jesus drank wine,'" Jerry remembered, and he said, "Well, I just like to be in control. I don't like to be drunk." It wasn't because of some religious reason. His father's contradictions would mold Jerry's entire life. Jerry Falwell Jr. was born in Lynchburg on Father's Day, 1962. He was the oldest of three children. His sister Jeannie was born in 1964. His brother Jonathan arrived in 1966. As patriarch, Falwell Sr. was the sun around which the family orbited. Naturally, his sons competed for his affection. It wasn't Cain and Abel exactly, but the brothers' relationship was never close. "Jonathan was just constantly copying me. Whatever I did, in a matter of time, he tried to duplicate it," Jerry told me. Jonathan Falwell declined to comment. It also didn't help that the brothers' personalities were so different. Jerry was the withdrawn, rebellious one. Jonathan, the gregarious rule follower. "The brothers just looked at each other as weird," a family friend said. It's ironic that Falwell Sr. was closest with his least outwardly religious son. "My dad and I were thick as thieves. He didn't see eye to eye with Jonathan," Jerry said. Temperamentally, the two Jerrys clicked. They loved playing jackass-style pranks on people. One time, Jerry Sr. put a live baby alligator in his wife Maycelle's bathtub. She nearly fainted when she found it, recalled Mel White, Falwell Sr.'s ghostwriter. Jerry Jr. once threw roadkill into a friend's car as it went by, causing everyone inside to scream. His favorite song for a while was Loudon Wainwright's Dead Skunk. At Liberty, Falwell Sr. terrorized students by speeding his SUV through crowded crosswalks. Jerry worried his dad would eventually run someone over, so he purchased a train horn with a compressor for his dad's SUV. Falwell Sr. loved driving around campus, blaring the deafeningly loud whistle at unsuspecting students. Jerry's relationship with his mother was another matter. Maycelle was a hardline Baptist and unsuccessfully pushed Jerry to adopt her rigid lifestyle. "I wasn't someone my mom could control," Jerry said. Jerry said Jonathan became his mother's favorite son. She realized Jonathan was someone she could control. Maycelle was thrilled when Jonathan later became a pastor. By the 1970s, Jerry Falwell Sr. was a national celebrity due to the popularity of his television show, The Old Time Gospel Hour. Whereas Billy Graham preached a gospel of redemption, Falwell saw himself as a field marshal in a cosmic battle between God and Satan. Jerry, then a teenager, frequently traveled with his dad to the front lines of the culture war. "We'd fly around on these old DC-3s from city to city. It was like the movie Almost Famous," he recalled. "I'd be the kid in the back of the auditorium selling my dad's books and records to people while he preached. I would have all this money stuffed into every pocket. That was my life." Looking back, Jerry said that his father's peripatetic lifestyle provided a reprieve from an oppressive marriage. My dad wanted to travel the world as an escape, Jerry said. He recalled that his mother's provincial worldview grated on his father. She wanted to live a small-town preacher's life. She didn't let him mess around, Jerry said. Divorce was out of the question. According to Jerry, his dad found ways to take the edge off at home, even though Maisel never allowed alcohol in the house. Sometimes he would drink a whole bottle of NyQuil. He called it Baptist wine, he remembered. Jerry grew up to learn that he too could have a private life that didn't align with his public persona. As I walked across Liberty's quad last August, giddy freshmen lined up at information booths to register for Orientation Week events, like passengers on a pleasure cruise, albeit a wholesome one. Liberty's strict code of conduct, known as the Liberty Way, forbids students from drinking, attending dances, or being alone in a room with a member of the opposite sex. Students can be fined $250 if they are caught attending events where alcohol is served. So there were nightly jazz concerts, bingo, and movie screenings. The student union had a bowling alley, ping pong tables, a video game room, and a creation museum. Students could even ski on a year-round slope cut into the 1,300-foot mountain behind campus. The theme park amenities were Jerry's vision. I'm not an artist, but for me, planning and developing the campus was my art, Jerry told me as we sat in his kitchen. Jerry Falwell Sr. founded Liberty in 1971 with the goal of creating a Notre Dame for fundamentalists. We're turning out moral revolutionaries, he once told the New York Times. But the school was still a largely unfinished canvas when Jerry enrolled in the fall of 1980. Not surprisingly, he chafed under the draconian rules, which at the time even banned R-rated movies. During my freshman year, my buddy and I went to a convenience store and I drank a few beers. I thought, I'm the wild one, Jerry recalled, laughing. Mostly, though, Jerry kept to himself. It was his way of coping with the feeling that everyone expected him to be a mirror of his preacher father. Jerry was awkward and shy, a classmate remembered. I grew up with too much attention, Jerry said. When your dad has a big personality, you don't compete. Jerry was at a spiritual crossroads. He didn't want to be a fundamentalist, but he wasn't an atheist either. Jerry said he majored in religious studies at Liberty so he could figure out what he really believed. It was during a course on apologetics, the study of defending Christianity to non-believers, that Jerry said he was persuaded it was rational to believe Jesus was literally the Son of God and the miracles of the Bible happened. I became a true Christian in college, Jerry told me. Newly confident in his faith, Jerry decided believing in Christ didn't mean he had to follow the evangelical rules. After all, Jesus was a rule breaker too. Organized religion says you have to earn your way to heaven. What Jesus said was, you just have to believe, he said. For graduate school, Jerry was determined to escape the fundamentalist fishbowl of Lynchburg. In the fall of 1984, he entered the University of Virginia Law School, 70 miles north in Charlottesville. It was Jerry's first time living away from home. And he could freely lead an outwardly secular life. He never bothered to join a church. If religion came up, he'd say, that's not me, that's my dad, UVA classmate David Freeman recalled. He was a normal guy, classmate Tom Angelo said. We played pickup basketball. He'd go to happy hour. One of his UVA classmates was John Hornsby, the younger brother of singer-songwriter Bruce Hornsby. One of the songs Bruce wrote had a few lyrics about a fat man selling salvation, Jerry recalled. Jerry said he laughed when he heard it. On a visit home during his second year of law school, Jerry ran into a vivacious Liberty freshman named Becky Tilley. Jerry attended Liberty with Becky's older sister, and he first met Becky when she was 13. Jerry was now 23 and Becky was 18. For their first date, Jerry took Becky to a drive-in to see The Terminator, rated R, by the way. They fell in love. Becky dropped out of Liberty after her freshman year and got a waitressing job in Lynchburg. She stayed with Jerry in Charlottesville on her days off. He had a motorcycle up there, and we'd go for rides, Becky recalled. Next photo, along for the ride, Jerry and Becky with their daughter, Caroline, son Wesley, and granddaughter at their family home in Good, Virginia, November 2021. The relationship escalated Jerry's conflict with his mother, who didn't approve of Becky's family. Maisel's objections infuriated Jerry, because on paper, Becky's family checked all the boxes. Her father was a multimillionaire real estate developer, devout Baptist, and a Jerry Falwell Sr. superfan to boot. The only show Becky's dad ever watched on TV was my dad's, Jerry told me. But Becky was from North Carolina, which from Maisel's Virginian point of view made Becky backwards, Jerry said. She said, "You can't be dating that hick from North Carolina," Jerry recalled. Jerry refused to end it. "I was like, I don't care what you think." Maisel retaliated and stopped paying Jerry's living expenses. Jerry said his dad loved Becky. He was very happy for us. It was a confusing and lonely time for Jerry. Needing a distraction, Jerry offered to help his father do research for his forthcoming autobiography. What he found out was a revelation. Jerry wasn't the black sheep after all. His religious father was the aberration. The articles revealed that the Falwells descended from a long line of rabble-rousers, drunks, and non-believers. His paternal great-grandfather, Hezekiah, was an avowed atheist and dairy farmer. His paternal grandfather, Cary, was a notorious bootlegger, or as Jerry put it, the ultimate entrepreneur. Jerry's great-uncle Garland was an alcoholic and drug addict. During Prohibition, Cary and Garland promoted cockfights and distributed illegal whiskey. The brothers later got rich owning bus lines, gas stations, a nightclub, and a hotel where they kept a bear chained up for drunk tourists to wrestle. Jerry Sr. and his twin brother Gene were born in 1933 as their parents were grieving two tragedies. In 1931, the Falwell's 11-year-old daughter died of appendicitis. A few months later, Cary shot and killed his 25-year-old brother Garland after Garland attacked Cary in a booze and barbiturate-fueled rage. Although a judge ruled the killing was self-defense, my grandfather, Cary, could never get over those two events, Jerry said. Cary Falwell died of cirrhosis of the liver in 1948 at the age of 55. The Falwell businesses were sold or closed. At the time, Jerry Sr. was on track to be another Louche Falwell. He would drink and party with his friends, Jerry told me. Falwell was a member of a teenage posse in Lynchburg called the Wall Gang, and routinely got into fights with rival crews. Every Sunday morning, Falwell's mother listened to radio preacher Charles Fuller on the old-fashioned revival hour, hoping her sons would hear the calling. Not long after Cary died, God answered her prayers. Jerry Sr. agreed to attend church. "My dad became a Christian because his mom pushed him in that direction," Jerry told me. Still, Jerry learned there were fleshly motivations driving his dad's faith journey. On Falwell's first visit to Park Avenue Baptist in 1949, he fell for the church's piano player, a devout auburn-haired girl named Maisel Pate. Falwell joined the congregation so he could date her, even though Maisel was engaged to a man studying at Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri. Falwell devised a plan to sabotage the competition. He enrolled at Bible Baptist College and arranged to be roommates with Maisel's fiancé. Falwell told the fiancé he could mail his love letters to Maisel. Instead, Falwell threw the letters in the trash. Maisel broke off the engagement. Months later, Falwell and Maisel were going out. My mom's mother was terrified when my mom was dating a Falwell, Jerry said. Looking back, Jerry said his dad adopted militant stands against drinking and homosexuality to prove to his wife that he would be a conservative Christian. My mother was the only reason my dad became puritanical, Jerry said. Jerry said his dad also knew that there was a lucrative market for such beliefs. He became a different person to build a church and a school, Jerry said. It was a point of pride for Jerry that his dad was friends with liberals like Larry Flint, Ted Kennedy, and Jesse Jackson. He really didn't judge people, Jerry said. In the spring of 1987, Jerry graduated from UVA Law School and returned home to Lynchburg, armed with this new understanding of his family's secular roots. My intent was to be a lawyer and commercial real estate developer, he told me. At a family dinner one night that summer, Jerry announced that he and Becky were getting married in a month. They probably thought she was pregnant, Jerry said. She wasn't. Shortly after a honeymoon in Bermuda, he and Becky bought their farm in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, which put a healthy distance between him and his parents. I wanted to come out here and be on my own, Jerry said. In the summer of 1988, Falwell Sr. called Jerry into a meeting and revealed a terrible secret. Liberty was on the brink of bankruptcy. Jerry was stunned. By all accounts, the school was thriving. Enrollment was up to 4,500. Construction was starting on a 12,000-seat football stadium and a 9,547-seat basketball arena. Unbeknownst to Jerry, his father had borrowed millions to finance the breakneck expansion and had no foreseeable way to repay the loans. Revenues for the old-time gospel hour, Liberty's main funding source, were plunging. The entire Christian broadcasting industry was reeling from the 1987 sex scandal that brought down televangelist Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Falwell told Jerry he desperately needed help restructuring Liberty's debt, or he would lose the university, church, and television show. Jerry took an office at Liberty down the hall from his dad. I just thought it was going to be part-time, Jerry said. Then he saw how deep a hole Liberty was in. Every day was survival, Jerry remembered. I was constantly on the phone with lenders and donors, trying to get enough money to meet payroll. One of the first things Jerry did was lobby his dad to pull the money-losing old-time gospel hour off the air. It was a painful concession for Falwell to give up the platform that made him famous, but he agreed. My dad didn't focus on Liberty until I got there, Jerry said. Falwell and Jerry worked well together because Jerry happily let his father be the front man. Around campus, people called them Big Jerry and Little Jerry. Falwell called his son J.J. Jerry was almost a recluse, a former colleague said. He would come in, usually through a side door, and go into his office and shut the door. Falwell often invited his son to join him and his chief of staff, Mark DeMoss, for lunch at the Holiday Inn near campus. Jerry rarely went. Instead, he often ate alone in a Wendy's parking lot, listening to Rush Limbaugh in his car. Talk radio became Jerry's political religion. Rush is the reason I became a conservative, Jerry told me. He keeps a framed photo of his first meeting with the late broadcaster at the 2018 White House Christmas party in his living room. That was the most starstruck Jerry had ever been, Becky said. There were some white-knuckle moments, but by the mid-1990s, Liberty's finances stabilized. God sent him to me just in time, Falwell wrote of his son's efforts in his autobiography. He is more responsible, humanly speaking, for the miraculous financial survival of this ministry than any other single person. Falwell rewarded Jerry's entrepreneurial prowess by delegating more and more of Liberty's operations to him. In truth, others, Like DeMoss's father, Art, a Liberty booster, played a role in the turnaround, as did a financial infusion from controversial sources, including the Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. Around the year 2000, Falwell broached the idea of succession with his sons. Falwell told Jerry and Jonathan that he wanted to divide his empire in two. Jonathan, the pastor, would inherit Falwell's church, Thomas Road Baptist. Jerry, the businessman, would get Liberty. Jerry said his dad never considered a role for his sister Jeannie, who had become a doctor. I asked Jerry why his dad didn't just give both to his brother, given that Jonathan abided by all the evangelical rules around drinking. My dad told me, "Use Jonathan for the preacher stuff, but don't let him get near the business," Jerry recalled. Jonathan did not respond to a detailed list of questions. In the spring of 2003, Falwell, then 70, asked Liberty's Board of Trustees to rewrite the bylaws and name Jerry his successor. Jerry told me he convinced himself that he would never have to do the job. He assumed his dad would live for another 20 years, and by then some other solution would present itself. On the morning of May 15, 2007, Falwell suffered a massive heart attack at his desk and died. He was 73. 3 days after Falwell's death, Jerry had to speak at Liberty's graduation in front of more than 15,000 people. "I was scared to death," he said. His anxieties only grew that summer. "It was the worst 3 months of my life. There was so much pressure on me to become somebody I wasn't," Jerry remembered. "I'd wake up each day saying, 'How am I going to do this?'" As Liberty's first family, Jerry and Becky became Christian celebrities overnight. "We had to put on an act," Becky said. Of course, Jerry could have stepped aside if he didn't intend to uphold the spirit of Liberty's extreme social conservatism. But that would mean Jerry would have to give up the power and privilege the job offered. As president, Jerry flew on Liberty's private jet and vacationed with billionaire donors. Jerry felt he had successfully compartmentalized his public and private identities for most of his life. Why stop then? Jerry distracted himself by focusing on his latest project, transforming Liberty's fledgling distance learning program into a profitable online university. Starting in the 1970s, Falwell's church sold VHS tapes of sermons and Bible study courses to Christians all over the world. Jerry realized that the proliferation of high-speed internet would make it possible for Liberty to stream college courses to students anywhere. In 2018, former employees told the New York Times and ProPublica that Liberty Online staffed a sales department of 300 telemarketers who worked for low pay and got only a 45-second break between calls. They aggressively recruited students who were often saddled with debt. By 2010, digital enrollment topped 50,000 and annual revenues reached $420 million. Becky, meanwhile, felt the thrill of a new opportunity in her role as Liberty's first lady. For 20 years, she'd been a stay-at-home mother raising three children. "I would get up and watch Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. That was my adult interaction, basically. The rest of the day, I'd wash clothes and cook," she recalled. Becky's stay-at-home life endeared her to her conservative mother-in-law. "Mom grew to love her when she saw what a great wife and mother she became," Jerry said. But as the wife of Liberty's new president, Becky had a new professional identity and responsibilities. It motivated her to get a makeover. She hired a personal trainer and bought a new wardrobe. Still, Becky felt lonely and isolated at home. Jerry was working all the time, and their marriage suffered. It was even more confusing for Becky when she walked around Liberty's campus and noticed boys noticing her. "They would give me attention that I'd never gotten before," Becky said. In February 2012, Becky turned 45. She and Jerry had been married for 25 years. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.